So now, you left in what month did you leave?
I left in June of 47, it was. I had gone to, I left the base, and I had gone to a replacement center called Zama. And we were waiting for a boat to leave, and this group I came in with, they all left, and I was the only one left there. Another group come in, and they left, and I was still there. So I figured, oh, goodness, my records are lost or something, you know. So I go up to the headquarters, and I start inquiring of why am I not leaving. You know, there's two groups, I'm gone, and I'm still here. So they check the records, and they said, well, she said, you're not going back to the United States. You're going back to Hawaii. You were drafted in Hawaii, and we're waiting for an airplane to take you back to Hawaii. I said, well, look, I don't live in Hawaii. And they looked, they said, well, you were drafted there. We got to send you back to where you were drafted. And I said, well, how do I get from Hawaii to home? And they said, that's your problem. So there was the officer in charge of the headquarters there. He came over and said, what's the problem? And I explained how I got through this mesh, you know. And he said, well, I'll see what I could do. So the next boatload came up. He said, I could get you to California. And that's the furthest. So I got to California. And when I got to California, I went from San Francisco. I went down to Los Angeles, saw the Art Center, kind of liked it. Thought, well, you know, in a few months I'd be out here, and went on home, and that's how I got back to Lansford.
So when you came back to Lansford, did you have the intention of going back to Los Angeles?
Yes, I did. They told me when I was there in June that they would accept me in September. And I thought, well, a couple months, you know, I could go home and meet some of the fellows, you know, that I grew up with and have a few beers with them and everything else. So right before Labor Day, I got a letter and said they can't accept me until January. So I didn't feel like laying around all that time or something like that. In the meantime, I heard about a job up here at the Morning Call as a photographer reporter, and I applied for it, and I got the job, and I got that in, I think it was in October of that year. And I thought, well, maybe this is even better, getting real life experience, you know, in photography instead of going to an art school or something. So I started to work for the Morning Call. I think it was like $29 a week at that time. And being as I knew this, Bill Tiley, who was head of the office at the time, called me in and said, can you use a camera, a speed graph? I said, sure, I loaded the film, went out and did a job, come back. He said, you got the job, you know. So I had a lot of experience with the speed graphic, you know, and the type of camera they were using. They were using a 3 1/4, 4 1/4 instead of the 4x5, but basically it was the same camera. And that's how I started work for the Morning Call. And through the Morning Call also is when we did the sit-down strike. That was the first picture in a book, the Lehigh book, and that was the beginning of the mind photographs also.
So that was in October 47? Or early 48?
That was later, yeah. I would take the camera, though, and roam around the region, you know, and take dredges down the Lehigh, you know, coal and different buildings and all that on weekends. But the mine photograph started with that sit-down strike. I think it was, what, 49 or something.
So your beat, as it were, was a regional beat.
Yeah, well, the branch office was in Lansford here. We had a branch office in, the main office was in Allentown, and we had a branch office in Easton, and one in Lansford.
So you worked out of the Lansford office?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I was, being as I was, you know, fairly well experienced with the camera, there was a violent air crash up near Mount Carmel. I think there was 56 people killed, and it was my day off. And I heard about it on the radio, and I got in the car, drove up to Mount Carmel, and took some took a series of pictures of this air crash and the victims and everything, and drove down to Allentown with it, and they published it, gave me a big spread, you know, and all that, bylines and everything else. And it was right after that they said, hey, let's get this guy to Allentown. So they moved me down to Allentown, and that's, I worked in Allentown there for a while.
And that was theoretically because that was more central to their
there, yeah, and you know, they had
so more of your work would get into the paper when you were there.
Yeah, and but the assignments were not to my liking too well. I mean, they did a lot of parties and groups and Lions Club's officers and things like that. And there was a number of good assignments you'd get. Went with the police on murders and things like that at night, which was neat, you know. But
a lot of it was sort of society pages.
And I think what soured me, I think I mentioned this once to you before about the 35 millimeter camera when I went out. Very few people were using 35 millimeter camera in news work, but Rose had one, a Leica. In fact, that was the Leica in that magazine. One day I was sent out to do an assignment of kids in a classroom, children in kindergarten, and I took the 35 millimeter and shot at available light, which was unusual. Everybody was using flash bulbs, you know, and big film and kind of pose things, and these were spontaneous. And when I come back, I printed them, and we had an old editor called Ned McGettigan, who was in his 80s, and he had these Ben Franklin glasses on his nose. He looked down at the pictures, looked at me, and looked down at the pictures, and looked at me, and started going through them. And in the meantime, my boss came in, Frank Marsteller, walked in the office. And he said, Frank, he said, why can't we always get pictures like this? And Frank said, well, he didn't know what to say, because he had a standard formula that you had to pose everything and hold the flash off on a 45 degree angle. He couldn't have it on the camera, had to be off, and that's standard. I mean, if you did vary from that, you heard about it, you know. I guess I did the wrong thing, you know, by doing this. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. I thought I was coming back with some good pictures and all that.
And the person you showed them to liked them.
Yeah, the editor, he thought they were great. He wanted to know why he couldn't get more of this stuff, you know, spontaneous pictures. Well, when I got back to the office, he told me, George, don't you ever do that again. You know, so
he was old school, you'd call him.
Old school, yeah. And then things started to turn a little, you know, and I thought, well, I didn't want to continue this. And I didn't stay there very long. And then they kind of persuaded me to go back to Lansford if I wanted to. You know, in the meantime, I met Gene. And we started a date and all that, and we got married, and that's another reason why I stayed around here.
Now, had you known Jean at all? She didn't go to Lansford High School,
no,
did she?
No, she went to St. Anne's. Jean's about 8 years younger than I am, and she was working up a little, up the Sharks news store up in town. And when I come out of the service, I used to walk up and get a newspaper every now and then. And that's how I got to talking to her and all that. And then,
what's Jean's maiden name?
Jean Gallagher. Actually, it's Genevieve. Everybody knows her as Jean. And we dated for a couple of years and got married. Yeah, we got married in 49. And a year later, we had our first child, Christopher. But
Now, what was it like coming back to Lansford after having been away? Now, you were away from about 42 to 47.
Yes, uh-huh.
That's longer than most people were away.
Yeah, it was. It was very, in the beginning, it was very strange. Everything seemed so small and confined, you know. And I still wasn't over my sicknesses real well, you know. I was having bouts with malaria and stuff like that, and I felt real bad, and I really didn't know what I was going to do until I got in with the newspaper and all that, you know. But for a couple of months there, it was strange. And like I said, I walked into this house and everything, the rooms looked so small, the stairs were so small, you know, and when you get out in the, you know, the big ocean and all that, it's different, you know.
But you didn't have an urge in those, even when the photography school, the art school got postponed, it sounds like you didn't actually have an urge to travel a bit or to go someplace else.
Well, I had, if I would have got started with the newspaper, I probably would have gone out. But I said, in the meantime, I started to date Jean and all that, and she didn't particularly, she was like a homebody, she didn't want to go anywhere, really. Later on, when I left the Morning Call then, and I started to freelance, and I started to do things around town, your commercial work. And Ted Berger, who was used to work for the Morning Call, left Lansford, went to Allentown, worked for the Morning Call there, and then
so I guess I was asking you whether you, you know, had thought about going other places a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I said I think if I would have got with the newspaper and met Gene or something, I probably would have gone out. Yeah, I had no qualms about traveling again. I thought, you know, Los Angeles would be nothing really, you know. So.
And how did Ted Berger fit into as a freelancer?
Yeah, when I started to freelance, I mentioned about Ted working for the Morning Call, and he started his own public relations firm. And he got the coal company account, the LCNN account, and anytime he needed any pictures, you know, and that's how I got to get down into the mine, you know, especially the coal hill colony.
So you two had both been assigned to the Lansford branch of the Morning Call?
Well,
he was a reporter?
He was there before I was. No, he was like an assistant manager, and then he went to Allentown. And when he got to Allentown, he got an offer or something to go in with another fellow named Ritter, and they formed the Ritter Berger Advertising Public Relations Firm, and then they got the coal account. And when he got the coal account, every time he needed pictures for annual reports or letters or promotions or something like that, he would call me and tell me to go down the mines and get this or that, and that's how I got into the mines, because coal companies were like other big companies. They didn't allow anybody in there. They didn't want anybody roaming around with cameras, and there was a lot of things they didn't want people to see. So this was an opportunity that I got, and that's how I was able to accumulate a fair amount of negatives when the LCNN was operating yet. And it wasn't that many years, you know, it was only about 2 or 3 years. Really.
You're talking pretty much till 54, till April of 54.
Yeah, it wasn't that long.
You probably started maybe around 1950 or 51 that.
So it wasn't that long, but what I did get, I was kind of fortunate that I did know Ted, you know, and he would always call me up a few days before, and he said, George, we got to have this picture, that picture. He said, I'll meet you down the mines. Well, when the night before came, he would always say, you go down. He said, you know what I want, you know, get it. And I would see one of the Larry Henry or Johnny Houghton or Ted had a brother too, Wilbur, and they would take me around, you know, and...
So because you were connected with Berger, you had entree.
Right, and I also took a lot of pictures I wasn't supposed to, but I figured as long as I'm down there and it looks interesting, I took it, you know, and I used a speed graphic down there, too, in the beginning, and it was kind of a cumbersome thing to take down the mines, because we were using flashbulbs, which was illegal. And they had to be connected to the shutter with the relay, and sometimes your bulb would go off, and then you could hear the shutter going off, and you'd say, I lost that shot, you know, and if I had all the shots that I lost, I would have probably twice as much too. But you run into all kind of conditions in the mine, especially real down deep, you know, dirty and dusty, and sometimes it's damp, and then your camera gets a lot of moisture on it, and then you try to, I mean, it's dry, and then it gets a condensation on it, and then the contacts don't work right, you know. So it was a trial by error thing too, and there was no books written on taking pictures in coal mines. So you had
so if we look at the company's annual reports in the last few years,
yeah,
the chances are pretty good that any mine photo that's in there, took.
Yeah, the last 4 or 5 years or whatever it was, the annual reports had, And then they had a lot of tours going in there, you know, the visitors, and they had other promotions. I remember going to Bermuda once with the coal dealers and all that. So it was a pretty good company. You know, they spent a lot of money too. And
this coal dealers was sort of a boondoggle to.
And I was making more money, you know, working a few days a week or something, or maybe 2 days a week. I was making more than I was making at the morning call. You know, twice as much. You know, so this was a good deal, and it allowed me a lot of free time to do other work. You know, to roam around the area and do things on my own. And I was doing other things. I had a little shop up on Birch Street that I rented, and I made a little dark room out of it, a little studio, and people would come in and I'd shoot a portrait or something like that. But I never cared for work like that, I did some weddings too, you know, and it was just mostly because when I was freelancing, you know, I had to make a living for my family too.
Did you put up a shingle at some point and advertise?
No shingle, but I just had some flyers made up or something like that. But as long as the coal company was operating, I was in fine shape, because I was making enough money, and I was getting Philadelphia prices instead of Lansford prices, you know, so it was a big difference, you know. So it worked out. I often wondered whether if I, you know, would have had this in with getting into the coal mines, whether I would have done any photography in the coal region. When I did come out of the service, too, and when I had the feeling that the mines were kind of, after I started freelance, I was offered a job at the National Gallery of Art in Washington as a photographer's assistant. They were just starting their photo lab, and I think the gallery just opened before that, and they were starting. What they were doing is copying paintings and things like that, putting them on cards, and then any dignitaries would come through the gallery, you'd have to photograph them for the papers and things like that. And I was offered the job, and I applied for it, and they accepted me, and they even found an apartment for me down there. And one day, Chris was born then, and he was just 6 months or something like that, and we went down and saw the apartment, and all the way back, she didn't say anything, and she didn't want to go to Washington, so I turned that job down. It was another thing, if I would have went to Washington, I probably wouldn't have done any of the coal mining pictures. Funny history, I mean, your whole life has to take certain turns or something like that. Well, you know, you do certain things, you make certain decisions, and maybe it turned out for the better. You know, you don't become rich or anything, but
you have a life's work that has such an integrity and a core.
Well, that's what I thought.
And that is that expresses you, and also this area from which you come, and you might not have felt able to do that photographing the artworks at the National Gallery or the visitors.
It was a lot different, sure, yeah. It was a different type of work. Sometimes you figure the job's a job, you know, and you'd have to make a living for your family. I was kind of disappointed, because I was always interested in art to a certain degree, good, you know, paintings and things like that. And I was kind of disappointed, but, you know, when she didn't want to go, you know, but it maybe worked out for the better, you know.
Now, in this period, did you do any formal training? in the period that, in terms of photography school, art school?
I never had any training at all, Tom. I never went to, not even to a workshop in my whole life.
So you picked these skills up doing the work, working the darkroom on your own materials.
Yeah. I had this darkroom up on Bird Street where they had the little shop, and then I also had one down in the basement. You know, I'd do it work at night, you know, for my personal work and things like that. And it was all through experience, magazines. No, I never went to, I had a high school education and that was it. Never even went to a workshop.
Would you say that there were certain photographers, did you become familiar with contemporary photography or?
Not at that time, no. I wasn't aware of photography outside of Lansford here really, or the other region, really, you know. In the 60s I started to, you know, about 59 or 60 I started to become acquainted with the New York scene, and when I started to sell pictures to magazines like the Saturday Evening Post, you know, and I would go to Philadelphia, you know, and then I was aware of other photographers. I was also offered a job with Popper Photography in New York, down on Park Avenue. And John Jerniak was the editor, and I learned from having lunch with him and visiting and all. I learned about other photographers like Edward Weston. That was the first time I became familiar with Edward Weston. I had no idea who Edward Weston was. And one day he sent me up to a studio up on uptown. He said, "This fella has some Edward Weston if you want to see." I asked him about how my printing was compared to other photographers. He said, "It's good," he said, "but it could be a lot better, you know." And he sent me up to this studio, and this fellow had about 15 Westons on the wall, and he did it all contact 8x10 prints, you know. And I thought they were beautiful. Really absolutely beautiful.
Now, was he printing Weston's work?
No. These were original
Westons. He had bought them.
He was selling them for Weston from some gallery in California, Carmel, I think. They were trying to sell them in New York. And you couldn't sell photographs. I could have bought a Weston in for $35, but I didn't have $35, you know. But I saw then that I could improve my printing. And I think that's how I learned how to print, by looking at other original photographs. And I would go to the Museum of Modern Art, and look at the exhibits there and see how they were printing and all. And that's how I learned how to print.
And did you find that you were able to, in fact, come back here, and as you did work in the darkroom, that you would try to get some of those effects, or you would try to get that contrast, or whatever?
Well, not so much that, but when you make a print, maybe you make it too gray or something like that, and you don't have enough body to it, you figure, I should print it darker, or I should print it deeper or something like that, and maybe get better blacks, you know. And you don't know this until you see another print. You can't see, some printing in books and all that is terrible, you know, it's gray. But you see the original print, and it's, you know, there's a lot to it. And that's how I learned how to, by studying other photographs. You talk about formal training, that was it, looking at other original photographs by masters. Some of the Westons now that I could have bought for $35, that pepper and the shell and all that, go like $70,000 now. At auctions. Well, the market's kind of dropped out of it now, but a few years back, Westons were going there $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, yeah. Originals.
Yeah.
Later on, his son started to print some of his negatives, and then, they were going for $4,000 or $5,000.